I'm an alcoholic. My name is Rick Lamp.
Rick.
By the grace of God and by following the suggested program of recovery as outlined in How It Works, I haven't had to take a drink since June 5th of 1991, and that is indeed a miracle. And I can provide references if anyone's interested. I gave Bud, when I first met him, I gave him my business card. I'm still waiting for a call, so I don't know what that means. I was born in a small town in Wisconsin. The year after I was born, there were 1,748 people in my hometown. We were small, everybody knew everybody, and from day one, I didn't fit. I don't know why, but I didn't fit. In our family, we're mostly German, so whenever somebody had a celebration going on, my dad would cook for us. He was a cook in the U.S. Army Air Force. He was stationed in India. And he'd get the family all together. They'd come up from all over, and we'd all enjoy each other's company. Now, I have four sisters and a brother, one of which is a twin sister. She is 5 minutes older than I am, and I never let her forget it. The story that my mother tells, and unfortunately she died a number of years ago, but the story she told was that we were born in July, so the party was probably outside. Told me to put me on the ground, and I kept crawling from chair to chair. Well, my dad worked at Pabst Brewery for over 30 years. So needless to say, there were a lot of beer. And it was cheap, too, by the way. I would crawl over to a chair, and I'd reach for the bottle that was on the ground, and everybody thought it was so cute, they let me have a drink. My mother says she poured me into bed that night. Now, I can neither confirm that nor deny it, but I was one. However, it sounds like something I would have done. Fairly typical childhood. If you ever watched Leave It to Beaver, I think our hometown was as close to his hometown as possible. We rarely locked the doors. Ran around all day. Streetlights came on, we came home. That's the way it was. In our house, if you didn't, you were expecting to get some type of corporal punishment. My dad did not believe in sparing the rod, and he certainly did not spoil his children. Gave us a set of values that I still try to practice somewhat today, and I got to keep going on that level. But school came pretty easy. I had the innate ability to remember stuff when they told it to me and spew it back at them when they asked for it. Did I learn anything? I'm not really sure. I often refer to my brain as that storehouse of useless information. You'd think I'd be great in trivia, but no. Can't remember at the right time. Not really had much in the way of drinking until I got into college. Now, in Wisconsin, they had a very interesting law. The state law for hard liquor and wine was 21. But they let each county decide if they wanted to allow 18-year-olds to drink beer at controlled locations. And the county I grew up in was one of them. So on your 18th birthday as a male, I had two responsibilities that I had to take care of. I had to register for the Selective Service Draft. Well, Vietnam War was going strong. And I had to get my Wisconsin ID so I could go to the minor bars. It was harder to get into a minor bar because there was cops at every door than it was to get into a regular bar. But I never looked old enough, so I couldn't get into the regular bars, so I had to go to the minor bars. Learned very quickly that it didn't make a bit of difference how much I drank. Somebody always said they drank more, so I just stopped talking about it. Would find out that things had happened while I was drinking that I didn't remember. You all taught me it was blackouts. Didn't really need to know that, folks. Didn't need to know that. Some things just better off without. Had good enough grades in high school to get into college, and I went over to the University of Wisconsin, which had the same drinking laws that my hometown county did. And I would love to blame alcohol for my scholastic problems, but I was just a lousy student. I had never developed good study habits because I never had to. And you start competing with 3,500 kids that have worked their butts off to get there. you don't tend to do well. Flunked the first course in my life my freshman year in college, first semester. Flunked calculus. Went home. I was afraid my dad was going to kill me. He just said, go back and try harder. So I did. I spent a lot of my time at Wisconsin on what they call scholastic probation. I have no idea what it was. But anytime your GPA for a semester was below 2, you went on social probation. Didn't stop me from doing anything. But 3.5 years in, I went into one of my engineering classes, and one of the guys that was in my dorm room or dorm floor my freshman year was there, and he was really smart. Last I heard, he was some muckety-muck over at Procter & Gamble in Ohio, so he did well for himself. But he taught me how to study. He helped me through, and that's the only reason I think I got out of college. The last semester, it was one of these things where, knowing that I was going to graduate, they put some special rules in place, and I had 16 credit hours. I had 8 of them pass-fail. Well, if I showed up, I was going to pass. I actually made Dean's List that semester. My parents thought it was a big deal. I'm going, who cares? I'm out. That's all I care about. I came out of college into a depression. Engineers were not being hired. And just to give you an idea of what it was like back then, this would have been 1972. I just celebrated 50 years at college last year. Yeah, I'm getting old. But starting salaries for engineers, chemical engineers, mind you, was a grand total of $900 a month. Took me almost a year to get a job out of college, but my first job was down in the Chicago area. Princely sum of $800 a month. I didn't know how you could possibly spend $800 in a month. That's how naive I was. I had no knowledge of the outside world. I had led a very sheltered life. All I knew was I was old enough to drink now. So I stayed with that company for about 4.5 years, and I got an offer from a company what was then known as Allied Chemical. They hired me to take over a sales territory in Michigan. It was my first move, and I never looked at it as a geographical. It was my first move. They gave me about a 30% increase over the money I was making in Chicago. They gave me an expense account of $25,000, and they gave me a car. And I figured, you are in tall cotton, which I was. I didn't know how good I had it back then. If I couldn't figure out how to spend $800 a month, how am I going to spend $25,000? They showed me how. Our group was a hard-drinking group of people. Any of the meetings that we had were always followed by significant happy hours and lots of booze. So I fit right in. I couldn't drink like they did, but I fit right in. A couple of years later, they told me I was moving to Boston. So Labor Day, I was up on my way over to Boston. I lived on the west side of town, and Boston was the same as Michigan. You found things to do, you found the bars where they were, and you just tried to keep going. A couple of years in Boston, I decided I was getting tired of having to pay rents without getting a tax deed write off on my taxes. So I started looking at the possibility of buying a condo. And I found some condos out in Holliston. If you're familiar with the Boston Marathon, that's where it starts. Grand total of $39,000. I didn't know how in the world, but I qualified for a mortgage. I came home on a Thursday from a trip. I don't remember where the trip was, but we were driving most of the time. And I ran over to the post office to make sure I could get my mail before I left the next morning, so I had to go to Providence, Rhode Island. There was a letter there from the bank I'd filed a mortgage application with to let me know that my mortgage had been approved. I was about to become a homeowner. So the next morning, I picked up this guy that was coming in from the airport, and we drove down to Providence to meet with a customer. Stopped along the way to call my boss. He says, how are you doing? I said, Jim, I just got approved for my mortgage. He says, that's too bad. You're moving to Atlanta. I never moved into that place. I had to go through a closing, but it went right back on the market the next day. Actually, the same day. So, down in Atlanta, first assignment that was given to me when I moved to Atlanta, I had to go to the PGA golf tournament. I could live like that. I could live like that. But Atlanta, just going around. Drinking progressed at this point to the point where I was drinking not just on weekends, but it was spilling into. It was starting on Thursdays and it was spilling into Monday. Did a lot of flying later on, but 7 a.m. flights when you're hungover is just awful. And then when you see somebody sitting in another part of the plane and he's ordering drinks and you go, oh, what a weakling he is. Dying to do the same thing. I managed to accomplish getting a DUI in Wisconsin. I'd been home for Christmas. And a bunch of kids I went to high school with were getting together for a minute, quasi-reunion. I got busted for DUI that night. Basically did not have any other issues to deal with. Settled all of that finally. Did have to go in for an alcohol evaluation. I met this one lady down off Windy Hill Road. She claimed to be a recovering alcoholic. She asked me all kinds of questions. I lied on every one of them. She said I was fine. I was willing to accept that. So then I transferred divisions. One of the areas that I had to go to in my original job was Macon. And this will come up again later, but there was a Sheraton Hotel in Macon on the north side of town. And the Masters Tournament was still a big deal, and still a big deal in Georgia. But it had kind of bled over into Macon. They actually had a Green Jacket restaurant in Macon at the time. But the hotel, the Sheraton Hotel, their lounge was the Sandtrap Lounge. And they had a wet ladies' night every Wednesday. But prior to that, that started at 7 o'clock. Prior to that, from 11 in the morning till 7 at night, it was happy hour and it was 3-for-1. Every time I participated in that, I was staying at that hotel because I wasn't driving. Why the Macon police didn't set up a DUI checkpoint? Because there's only one way in and out. They could have, you know, financed the whole state, the whole town budget on that. But transferred to a different division, and now I had to start flying. And the guys that I worked with, they were really heavy drinkers. We would get on back then, and we had a company issued airline credit card. And we were paying full coach fare, because that's what they told us to do. If you were paying full coach fare, and you kicked in another $35, you got upgraded to first class. So our objective was always get the upgrade, and then drink the free booze to match the upgrade. Now, it was $3 a bottle. You're looking at least $35 to get to first class, even on the short hops. So we'd walk off these planes, and we would just be out of it. Completely out of it. And we thought it was perfectly normal. But going on and on. And just from that point on, it just started progressing. I was drinking 5, 6, 7 days a week, depending on what week it was. Wasn't missing work, but I wasn't being real productive either. And in late 1990, one of the distributor reps that I worked with was having a Christmas party at their home, and I managed to hit a parked car on the way back. I was in a blackout. All I remember is the bang. And I tried looking around, seeing what's going on. I couldn't figure out why the rearview mirror on the right-hand side was now inside the car. That took a while. Flat tire and all things. So I just left the scene. And the state patrol came the next morning, interviewed me. Issued me 2 tickets. They probably should have still gotten me for DUI. I think I was still drunk. But they issued me 2 tickets, and I had to come down in January for a court case. So I go to the court case, and I've got my business suit on. I've got my briefcase with me. And the one guy sitting next to me says, are you a lawyer?
Yes.
He didn't want me for a lawyer. So they're you know, and I come up before the judge, and he asked the prosecutor, you know, here's the charge. He says, well, let's fine him $75 for the one and 50 for the other. Judge says, no, I'm going to fine him 50 for one and 35 for the other. I had $1,000 in cash in my pocket, plus my checkbook, because I figured I was really going to have to buy my way out of this one. Got really upset on the way out because I gave the lady a $100 bill and she didn't know how to make change. Ain't that tough. There ain't that much left of it. So we had a national sales meeting for our division a few weeks later. It was down at Marco Island in Florida. And after one of the short sessions, we were supposed to play golf that afternoon. My manager took me aside and told me that because of the incident with the rental car, that I was going to have to get some kind of alcohol rehab. Now, just to digress just back a little bit, when I filled out the accident report, I came up with some story that when I looked at it after I wrote it, I didn't even believe it. And I had just written it. So I put down three words that probably changed the opinion of everybody, and that was, had been drinking. So he told me, and I was really pissed about that. But so I found out about, I don't know if any of you are familiar with him, but the late Obie O'Brien used to run a treatment counseling session on South Cobb Drive, South Cobb Parkway in Smyrna. And so I went there, and the place was called SIOGA. It is an acronym for Sobriety is Our Greatest Asset. Okay, if you say so. And he would tell me about all this stuff about, well, the first night I was there, he celebrated 17 years of sobriety. And I walked up to him after the session, and I asked him what it was like to be 17 years sober. And he looked right at me and says, when you get 17 years, you come and tell me. Mm-hmm. That's not what I wanted to hear. I didn't plan on sticking around just long enough for the heat I was in to die down, and I was going back to the way I used to be. By that time, I was drinking every day, and if I could tell you what happened in 10 hours in a day, I was having a good day. Found out where every town I went to, I found out where all the liquor stores were. Half the time, it was just a guess of what I was actually supposed to be doing, but whatever. It came down to the day I took my last drink. I had been working over in Mooresville, North Carolina, at one of the Parker subsidiaries. They made a lot of valves and everything for a lot of different industries, and they were looking to convert to a different solvent than the one they had been using. I did about a half day's work there, drove back to the hotel, got drunk as soon as I got there, woke up 4 o'clock or so in the afternoon, got something to eat, came back home, and I realized on that day that even though I was still drinking, if I kept drinking the way I was going to, I was going to die. So that night, and I had heard from Obie that, you know, if you're looking for help, get down on your knees and pray. So I got down on my knees and I prayed, God, let me sleep through the night. That's all I asked for. Let me sleep through the night. And I did. And you'd think that would have been enough to get me. I had to go to sessions on Thursday night, so I came back from Charlotte on Thursday. The bottle of scotch I had in the trunk of the car, I threw in the trash bin on the way into the complex. We went to the session, and he had a helper with him. And I walked in there, I looked at him, I couldn't remember this guy's name to save my soul. He looks at me and he says, temporary insanity? And I said, nope, I think it's permanent. That didn't help. So, Friday night, I went to my first AA meeting. And about the only, first of all, I knew exactly where this place was and I couldn't find it. I went trying to get down to Rebo's in Smyrna. They had told me where it was. I couldn't find that place to save my soul. Got in there. It was after the meeting started. Grabbed a cup of coffee, sat in the back. And the first thing that went into my mind when I walked in there, now you have to understand, I had a pair of slacks on and a polo shirt. First thought that comes to my mind is, God, I'm overdressed. Like it really matters. The only thing I did right that night was at the end of the meeting, they talked about sponsorship, and I walked over to this little booth they had, and I was introduced to my first sponsor. My first sponsor was Bill W. Not that Bill W. I'm not that old. He worked for Lockheed, and he gave me his business card, and he said, you call me every day. So he had his business number on there, and he had his home number on there. Now, being the smart engineer that I am, I figured out if he was at work, I could call his house. I wouldn't have to talk to him. He called me back. He knew me better than I knew myself. So I'm going along, and I am doing probably nothing that would be recommended to a newcomer. I'm going to meetings, but that's as far as it's going. Left to my own devices, I'm as nutty as a loon. And all they told me was keep coming back. And my sponsor told me, see, you keep coming back till your ass falls off. And if it does, we'll teach you a new way to sit. And he meant it. He meant it. At this point in time, I was shortly after I had my last drink, and they told me I had to go through this whole thing. I went through a whole bunch of the counseling. I was drinking most of that time, but I was in St. Louis on a Friday afternoon. I had just been working over there for the week. And I called into the office on Friday afternoon to see if I had any messages. And there were two messages there. One was to call this regional manager that I didn't work with directly, but he was the one I was supposed to call back, and one of my coworkers. So being the dedicated dead employee I am, I called the regional manager first. He says, I want you to meet me Monday morning, 8 a.m., at this hotel right near the Atlanta airport. And I said, well, that's kind of weird, but okay. So I called a coworker, and he says, did you get a note from this guy? I said, yes. Did you call him? I said, yes. You shouldn't have. You're being let go. I got riffed. Went down there Monday. He gave me this whole pack. I knew more about what was going on than he did, which is sad to say. So I'm about 4 months sober, and this started the week. So Monday I was told I was losing my job. I had for almost 15 years. I'm one of these crazy people. I never lost a job drinking. I lost four of them after I quit. Figure that out. I can't do anything the right way. So on Tuesday, the girl that I had been involved with called me up. She had talked to me the day before, and I'd been really rude to her. And she told me to go pound sand and hung up. Wednesday, nothing serious happened, but on Thursday, I got a note that I had to have a meeting with State Patrol. And they have an office up on the North Loop in Marietta. So I go there, and the sergeant comes out, and he tells me, your license is being suspended for 120 days. And I looked at him, and I said, why? I hadn't done anything wrong in Georgia now, mind you. Yeah. Qualification there, Georgia. Well, you pled no contest to this charge, and that's the same thing you pled to that other charge, so we're going to suspend your license. Well, what about, I'm unemployed looking for work. She says, oh, don't worry, they'll give you a temporary license to go, to work and everything. So I get onto the motor vehicle department, drive, by the way, park the car about a block and a half from the office so they don't see me driving in, only walking. Wait in line, and I told the guy what I was there for. I give him my license, and I said, what do I need to do to get the temporary? He says, you're not getting a temporary license. I said, but I need to be able to drive because I'm looking for a job. He says, you thought about that before you did it. I was so pissed, I walked to my car and drove home and kept right on driving. It's getting near the end of the suspension, and a friend of mine was coming in. One of the guys I used to work with was coming in to visit a customer in Atlanta and wanted to know if we want to get together and do something. I said, why don't we go play golf? Because I had an out-of-town membership at a club up in Norcross. Well, it was one of those nights when the temperature dropped below freezing. And if you know anything about golf courses, the superintendents will not let you play when there's frost on the green. So by the time we got there for our 11 o'clock tee off, the guys at 8 o'clock hadn't teed off yet. And I just kept pushing tee back. And finally my buddy says, nah, he says, I got to get back home. He lived in Baton Rouge. So he takes off in his rental car, and I take off in my car to go home. Now, I'm smart enough to know, or at least I thought I was smart enough to know, cops probably aren't going to bother you if you're doing the speed limit on 285. You might get run over, but they're probably, cops aren't going to bother you. Got off a few exits before the big intersection with 285 and 75, took some of the back roads. The last road that I was on was, turned off Terrell Mill, went onto Bentley Road, and I was headed north on Bentley Road towards my condo. And as I crest over the hill, there's four Cobb County cops doing license and registration checks. And I have neither. I'm going, all right, I'm going to jail. There's no way around it. I'm going to jail because driving on a suspended license, you're going to jail. What prompted me to do this, I'll never know, but I just turned the turn signal on. Cops saw that I was trying to turn into my complex. He let me go. Let me go through. Nothing. Parked the car and I was shaken. Absolutely shaken. See, I had been blessed to have the obsession to drink removed very early on. And I know that my God has a sense of humor because he left the insanity. That was the day that I realized that my life was unmanageable and that I was crazy. And I'd listened enough in all these meetings I'd gone to that the solution seemed to be this action they kept talking about. So the following day, I pulled out a pad of paper up in my office and I started writing out my fourth step. And it wasn't too hard at first because the people I was listing, I was still pissed at. That flowed really well. Did that for a while, seemed to hit a wall, so I stopped. Next day, I sat down again, and more stuff started coming to me. I mean, I was going back as fourth grade. And so I got that all on paper, and when I finished it the last day on a Friday, I just couldn't think of anything else. So when I went to the meeting that night, I sat down with my sponsor, and I asked him if he would be willing to hear my fifth step. And he looked at me kind of strange, but okay. So I go over to his house Saturday afternoon. And he looks at me and he says, have you ever done third step? Now, I probably had in my own way, but not as the book lays it out. So he says, okay, we're going to take third step prayer. I said, okay. He says, come over here. We're on our knees, holding hands, and saying a prayer. Men didn't do that in the 90s. Just didn't do it. I'm thinking, what the hell did I get myself into? So I go through and I'm listing all the people and places and things, etc. And he keeps asking me these questions, like, did you ever do this? And I'm thinking to myself, was I supposed to? I had to learn that I didn't have to be as bad as he was. He was a electronics engineer on the P-3 aircraft. And he got sober in a tent in Iran, of all places, teaching the Shah of Iran's pilots how to use the electronics on the P-3. And he went through Loners International. How many people in this room know what Loners International is? That's when you wrote letters to people whose names you got and waited for a reply. That's how people got sober in back then. If you couldn't get to a meeting, that's how they got sober. Anyway, we got through that. The one and only time after we finished, he hugged me, said, welcome to AA. I'll see you at the meeting tonight. And the first set of meetings that I went to, the third day that I was, the third meeting I went to, fourth day sober, it was a speaker meeting at Rebo's. And I walk into place, and I'm looking around the room, and I see this guy in a suit. And the first thought that comes in my head is, boy, is he overdressed. I look at him again and say, oh, he looks awful familiar. It was my neighbor. Harold I. His name will come up again a little bit. So, I joined this group that met down at it's a hospital on Austell Road. It used to be Cobb General Hospital. It's now part of the Wellstar system. They had a meeting there on Fridays and Sundays. And I was going to that. I took that as my home group. I didn't want Rebo's because I thought that was just too weird. And one of the things that the companies that I worked for did was there was always a big electronics show in Anaheim, California, early in February. We'd go out there every year. It was a five-day show, so we were out there for a long period of time. But I came back from that, I think it was the second year I was sober. And the group had decided in their infinite stupidity to make me chairperson of the group. And I knew that I had arrived. I was going to fix that group. Well, I'll skip a little bit, but the best thing that happened to that group was my getting a job out of state. But Bill would travel to different Lockheed plants across the country when they had situations going on. So he had been out of town for a few days, and I was going through the motions. I'd be at the meeting. I was recovered now, guys. I've done my steps. That's all that needs to be done. I was recovered, and I was very, very unhappy with what was going on. So on a Sunday afternoon, I called him up, and I said, he asked me how I was doing, and I said, Bill, I'm feeling disconnected. Now, if you've ever gone through a situation like this with your sponsor, he said those words that they just have this way of coming up with. And his answer to me was, why'd you pull the plug, stupid, and hung up? And I knew exactly what he meant. I was trying to rest on laurels I didn't have. Anyway, one of the women that was in this group that I was involved with, we got close, and I got asked to take a job in Amarillo, Texas. You've heard the old saying that the best thing to come out of Birmingham is I-20. Well, the best thing to come out of Amarillo is I-40. And we decided to get married. We got married in November of 96. I was just over 5 years sober. I use that word loosely because my sponsor referred to saying, you know, you're as dry as a popcorn fart and about as valuable. And we got married, and she moved out to Amarillo, and we both learned to hate it. I was traveling all the time. She was responsible for taking care of the house. Her son was living in her house in Ackworth, and I still had my condo in Marietta. But I was making enough money that we could pay all the mortgages. But even though I was doing well at work and making a lot of money, it just wasn't, you know, I was going to maybe 3 meetings a month if I was lucky. She didn't go to many more. She couldn't find full-time work. So it's just kind of the disillusioned with the discontented. And about 5.5 years in, the sales manager convinced the owner of the company that he could, it didn't matter, it didn't make any difference where he lived as long as he lived near an airport, and he got to move to Denver. So I approached the guy and said, hey, can I move too? I'd like to move back to Atlanta. And they finally agreed to it. So in February of 2002, we moved back to Atlanta and bought our house here in Woodstock. When we got married, I went from a 47-year-old bachelor to a husband, father, and grandfather in about 15 minutes. And my dad had come to the wedding, and he calls me over and he says, why didn't you tell me you had a granddaughter? And I said, because I didn't know until right now. Naive. All caps. Shout it out. So we get back here, and I had part of the responsibility I had was every month I had to do a report for the company I worked for and for the company that was supplying us the product we were selling. So I got up on a Monday, and I went down to my computer, and I logged into the computer in Amarillo and did my reports and everything. About 11 o'clock, the phone rings, and it's the sales manager calling. He's letting me know that I don't have a job anymore. Lynn doesn't have a job. Oops, we got a problem. So that day, a guy that used to be my sponsor called me up and asked me if I would go to a meeting that night where he was getting his 25-year chip. I said, okay. Well, the man who officiated at our wedding was present there, Reverend Chuck. I go up to Reverend Chuck after the meeting, and tell him, you know, he talked to me. He says, how are you doing? And I start going into this whole litany. I said, my God, I don't know what's happened. I just lost my job. We got three mortgages, no money. And he looked at me and he said, the promise says that fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. It doesn't say the economic insecurity is leaving us. These are things that I should know. And I didn't. Again, a number of years later, I was going to a meeting over here in Woodstock, and I was at that convention again out in California. And I come back from the trip, go to the next meeting when I'm home, and they tell me that I've just been elected intergroup rep. And I'm going, what? By the way, if you're ever in a group, make sure you show up for group conscience. You get jobs otherwise. So they had to tell me where the meeting was, and I had no idea what in-group was. I had never heard about groups outside of the group. So I go there, and it meets over at the NABA Club. It meets on Sunday, first Sunday of every month. And all of a sudden, I start to get an idea of what's going on outside of my little group. And it was a really interesting experience. Really interesting experience. So I did my 2 years, and elections are coming around, and I'm getting to rotate out of intergroup. And they said, well, we need an alternate GSR. Well, everybody knows an alternate doesn't do anything, and I'm capable of doing that. So I volunteered. A week later, they told me, you have to be in Macon on Friday. And I said, why? We are going to assembly. I said, what's that? I said, just go to Macon, go to the hotel. And find. Now, the Marriott Hotel that we met at then did not exist when I was going there back in the 80s. So I had to find out where it was. Got one of the little director or guidebooks that they have at the hotel, and they had a nice little layout map. So I found the place. I walk up to it, and I see an area that looks like it's registration. So I walk up to the registration desk. The guy looks at me and he says, what district are you in? You might have been talking grief. I don't know. I looked at him like, what? District. What county do you live in? Ah, that one I know. Cherokee. Okay. He gives me the book. And it's, if you're interested, it's 14C. The whole county. By the way, just as an aside, there are more AA groups in District 14C than there are in any other district in the state of Georgia. Just an aside. Anyway, go into the assembly on Sunday morning, which is the day when you do votes and everything, get the presentations. First person I run into, Harold I. He's over 40 years sober now. But I go in there, and now I'm starting to learn how this whole thing operates, both at the district level, GSR, which I had no idea of, and also at the state level. And it's a really intricate, fine working situation that works in spite of the alcoholics who are in it. It's just absolutely amazing. So I do, and it turns out that the person that I replaced as GSR was my sponsor in that group, and he was also being GSR for a different group. So when my 2 years were up, it was time for new people, and John over there was the treasurer. John wanted to rotate out. I can balance a checkbook. So I figured, okay, I can be treasurer. My sponsor says, no, you would be a good DCN. And I looked at him like, what? What is wrong with you people? Why do you keep asking me to do things I can't do? It makes no sense. But sure enough, another thing, when voting's going on, if you don't say no when you're nominated, you're going to get the job. So I became alternate DCM. Still had no idea what was going on. That's when I started to see that now they're holding GSR in orientation courses and everything at assembly so that people know what the thing is. We had been at an assembly, or not an assembly, but a prepaid convention in Jekyll Island. And we got there early one night for the speaker meeting, and there was a couple behind us, and we started talking. They were from South Carolina, and they found out I was GSR. And she said, "What kind of training did you get?" And I'm going, "There's training for a GSR?" News to me. But you start going to this, and the whole thing is you have to be able to have communication from the top to the bottom and from the bottom to the top. And that's where this whole thing really becomes interesting, because we can come up with all kinds of ideas, and we can pass it through to them, and it will be reviewed. That much I can guarantee you. It may not be acted on, but it will be reviewed. But they kept asking me to do these things. I rotated into the DCM position, and that's three assemblies a year, district meeting every month, and two other meetings that are down. They're still down in Macon. The assemblies are now down in Dublin. I don't know how much longer they're going to be there, but so you've got a pretty good commitment. And that's the one thing I found about taking some of these positions is it reinforces the commitment to sobriety, because you have to be willing to give up the time. And if you're not willing to give up the time, you're not going to be very effective in your position. Doing these reports and everything, trying to figure out what you need to pass on to the GSRs that they can take back to their groups so that the group can be informed of what's going on. It's strange, because they actually thought I was doing a good job. The delegate actually asked me to chair the speaker meeting on Saturday night at one of the assemblies. And I always tell people when they're asking about chairing a meeting, I say, it's no big deal. There's a format. Just follow the format. It's a little bit different when there's 300 people in a row. Got through it. Got to tell a bad joke. That's what I do. Anyway, when it was getting to be time to rotate out, my alternate DCM got a job that was going to create a conflict, so I wound up doing a third year as DCM. And by that time, by the end of that third year, I was burned out. I was burned out. I had been through the COVID period. I was tired of Zoom. I'd been to more Zoom meetings than I cared about. I did find out that all the groups I typically went to were meeting in person, so that helped a great deal. But I rotated out, and it was like, I'm free. Well, that's when I decided I was going to have my knee replaced. And there ain't nothing free about a knee replacement. Also, that's when the vaccinations for COVID started. So between COVID vaccinations and knee surgery, I pretty well shot the next year. But about halfway through the year, I wasn't even finished with my rehab, I started to miss the service. Mm-hmm. And from my previous exposure, I knew that the treasurer wanted to be rotated out because she had been there for 5 years. So I sent her an email and said, if you're still willing to rotate out, I'll be willing to take your place. And they accepted graciously the volunteer. There are a lot of things that go on in AA. We are the only state in the United States that has a prepaid state convention. And if you haven't been to one, it's in Augusta this year in October. I really recommend that you get there. There's some great speakers. It's a great time for fellowship. You get to see what goes on outside of Woodstock, outside of Canton, outside of Cherokee County. Service is what cemented my relationship with AA. Now, when I was first starting out, my sponsor would tell me, as he ordered me to clean ashtrays and wipe down tables and put coffee cups in the dishwasher, you're being of service to AA. Bull. He was hazing me. The only reason I had to do it was because I was the new guy. And, you know, I've heard over the years that you ask people to do this who aren't ready yet or haven't gotten to the point where they can be of service to other people, but they can free up their time by taking away some of the requirements. And that's something I understand today. A lot of what I know today, I did not understand when I got here, and for a long time after I'd been here. If you had seen me 4 to 6 months into my dry period, I won't even admonish you to call it sober. I was restless, irritable, and discontent, and it showed. I would ask my sponsor why he didn't want me talking in a meeting, and he would say, "Well, the purpose of an AA meeting is to pass the message of hope on to someone who is still suffering from alcoholism. You don't have a message. All you have is a mess. Don't share it with anyone." My sponsor was not warm, soft, and cuddly. He had all the warmth and sensitivity of pre-stress concrete. But it was exactly what I needed at that time. Because if he had been soft, I wouldn't have done it. I would not have progressed to the point that I am today. I've always been told it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak at a meeting. I have yet to see anybody fall asleep or walk out. Well, I take that back. Someone walked out just a few minutes ago. I think they had another conflict, but again, it's just a case of what do I have to say that's going to have an impact? And I never know. I don't know if I've said anything that's going to have an impact. But nobody's gotten drunk. That's about the best I can hope for. It's been a privilege being up here. I've been coming to this group for 4 or 5 years now. And I will say that the people who attended this group when I first started coming here, probably half of them no longer come to this particular group. Why, I don't know. But I also know that I was told early on that AA is a passing parade. And that I would go to more funerals than weddings. Get a dark suit. So, anything that I can possibly do that might help someone, that's why we have that responsibility pledge. If anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there, and for that I am responsible. And I can't be responsible if I'm not here. Thank you.